I wanted to pass around two things that you could get from that website of oabigbook.info. So one of the documents is what's called a schematic outline of the big book. It's like a frame, an outline, you know, 1A, 1B, 1C, 1C1, 1C2, things like that, which is the equivalent of what they used to do in the 1700s and put in little sort of like subheadings within a paragraph to tell you where you are. It's one thing about the big book, it flows, and you don't really know where the subheadings are, and I hope this gives you a sense of that. And the other one is a list of, I think it's pretty exhaustive, of all the promises from each step in the big book. And you'll note that there aren't a lot of promises for some steps, and there are a lot of promises for others, and we'll be talking about that today. I also, I understand the pictures didn't get all the way back, so I'm going to send my pictures around again. Who wasn't here yesterday? Oh, a lot of you, so, well, you missed one of the most eloquent, greatest speeches. The experience of a lifetime, you can never recapture it. I'll do a little bit of a summary for you, but these are pictures, most of them of me, when I was not quite at my heaviest, but pretty heavy. Then there are happier pictures, which were taken at Stepping Stones in Bedford Hills, New York, which is where Bill Wilson, the co-founder of AA, and Lois Wilson, the co-founder of Al-Anon, lived for many, many years, and it's now a museum. So I'll start passing around. If you've seen them already, please let them go all the way to the back.
Is Stepping Stones a city? Or is that like the name for the house?
Stepping Stones is the name that Bill and Lois gave to their house, which is in Bedford Hills, New York. And it's, I think you have to make, appointments to go there, but it's a pretty amazing place for those of you who, like me, are crazy about the history of these remarkable people. What I talked about yesterday, just very briefly, I'm going to talk about now what I talked about at length yesterday, is that the big book, for all of its difficulties in having it read today in today's world, it was written basically by white Christian men who had been in the gutter in AA, who had done bad things, not had bad things done to them, who lived in a world in which the universal pronoun was he, not he or she or them or whatever. It was a world in the United States, much of the world, where women were the little woman at home, and they're the ones who cooked and did the dishes and did everything, and while the men pontificated and did important things. And it's very hard for someone like me and a lot of people in OA and it was written in a language that is quite old-fashioned. Look at our tradition, whichever one it is, lest problems of money, property. Where's the last time you ever heard the word lest, other than in some biblical context? I mean, it's very old-fashioned. The word terrific is used in the big book to mean bad, not good. So there are a lot of words that are used differently, and it's written pretty paternalistically. The chapter to the wives, although it contains some really good advice, is really hard to read for many, many people. But it is a brilliant book, and it was designed for people who did not have anyone from AA around to help them work what became the 12 steps of AA. And those instructions are still, if they're understood carefully, and as they apply to OA, because there are differences, and that's one of the things that I hope to be able to accomplish for you, those instructions have been able to get people in recovery relatively quickly, very powerfully, and to stay recovered for the rest of their lives. For millions and millions of people, not just in AA, but there are many different fellowships, in which the big book has been used. In Owe is certainly one of them. It's not the only way of working the steps, and as I said yesterday, I have many of my mentors in this program, people I consider more spiritual, who have suffered more, who have been absent longer, lost much more weight, people I really humbly admire, did not use the big book to work the steps, and they recovered and they continue to recover. So I don't say it's the only way. But it is a very useful way, and studying the big book certainly is a good way of waking you up to what's valuable about your program. If you're working, it's working well for you. If you're not, if what you're doing isn't working for you, maybe you should be trying out the big book way, because it certainly has stood the test of time in terms of its instructions. I also indicated yesterday that I owe almost everything I'm going to be telling you to other people who have studied the Big Book and have thought about its application to Overeaters Anonymous. Particularly, I give the most particular credit to Joe and Charlie, AA speakers. There have been two Joes. One Charlie passed on, all of them have passed on by now, who sort of pioneered in the I think the early 60s and going on, for a very, very long time, speaking to, I don't know how many, thousands and thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of AAers and OAers and in other fellowships, working through the language of the Big Book and explaining, its directions. And then one of their students, a man who lives in my hometown named Blaine, I think stood on their shoulders, stood on the shoulders of those giants, and came up with some stuff that really helped me understand the Big Book as it applies to OA. So, having said all that, what I talked about yesterday at a great deal of length is the notion that begins the Big Book, the message from the doctor, Dr. William Silkworth, who was the first person, at least apparently the first person, who was treating alcoholics, who was having almost the impossible task of trying to keep them sober, and couldn't, and who had come up with a theory that was revolutionary and is still not accepted by doctors as a definition of addiction. You know, if you look in the diagnostic statistical manual for definitions of addiction, alcoholism, things of that sort, you will see that they're defined using sort of three different concepts. One is frequency, another is amount, and the third is detriment, how bad it is, how badly it affects you. And the more you drink, the more often you drink, and the more it affects you, the more you fall within the definition of an addiction. But the Big Book, following Dr. Silkworth, makes it, I think, really quite clear that the kind of alcoholic who will respond to the 12 steps is not necessarily someone who frequently binge drinks, not someone who is so down and out that he or she, has lost everything, but a person who has a peculiar combination of two problems, two abnormalities. The first we discussed yesterday at length, and the second I'm going to discuss at length this morning. The first one is that what the Big Book says, we must believe that our bodies are different, that they're abnormal, that they have a reaction of craving when they ingest, for the alcoholic, when they drink any alcohol, that the alcohol produces in them a need for more that is the equivalent of not being able to stop blinking for any more than, I don't know what the world's record is, 30 seconds or something like that, or a minute, or maybe 2 minutes. But at a certain point, your body says, I'm going to blink whether you like it or not. And I didn't know this, but the world record for holding your breath is, you know, I just forgot. I was going to say, but it's at least 6 minutes, which is unbelievable to me, because I can't hold my breath for longer than probably a half a minute. But at a certain point, your body says, you're going to breathe. And it does. And we can't stop our heart from beating. Some people say they can slow it down. We can certainly, in some way, maybe stop the pounding of the heart if we're very frightened or things of that sort. But we can't stop certain parts of our bodies from doing what the body does. And it's that same thing that the abnormality of the addict is like. It's the body says, I want more, where normal people don't want more. You know, you can be a heavy, heavy drinker and get drunk once every weekend. But at a certain point, if you're not an alcoholic, your body will say, I can't take this anymore. And that's certainly true for a lot of people who are overweight or who eat too much. At a certain point, they will say, I guess I just won't eat that much. Or they join a support group that gives them all they need, which is, you know, you just don't have to eat that much. And they get full. And normal people do get full. And when they get full, they don't want to eat anymore. They may stuff themselves at a Thanksgiving dinner or something like that. But the next day, they don't go out and eat again. They say, I'm too full. Whereas, that's never happened to me. I would say never in my whole life have I ever felt too full to eat the next day or even an hour later, if it was something that I had cravings for. So on the one hand, we get these cravings. And I spent a lot of time, because the biggest problem with OA, because we're an umbrella fellowship. We're not Fataholics Anonymous, Chocoholics Anonymous, Sugaraholics Anonymous, you know, Floweraholics Anonymous. We don't have one substance or one eating behavior that is common to us all. Some of us can eat what others of us cannot, and vice versa. Actually, I think that's a tautology. I think that's, some of us can eat what others can't. Yes, and others can eat what some of us can't. That's the same thing. But there's an overlap, I'm sure, for many of us. But at one end of the spectrum, and at the other end of the spectrum, there may be no overlap whatsoever. So that one person can eat everything that another person can't, or and vice versa. So we really have it more difficult in that one area. But don't let anyone say to you, well, alcoholics have to, they just have to stop drinking, but we have to eat. Alcoholics must drink. They just can't drink alcohol. We must eat, but we just don't have to eat the foods or indulge in the eating behaviors that cause us cravings. And I went on at some length to talk about how to develop a plan of eating, because I think that is an area in which OA is quite derelict, although we have two wonderful pamphlets, one called A Plan of Eating, the other called A Dignity of Choice, or Dignity of Choice, which both provide guidance in that area, and the latter of which says very clearly, it's the group conscience of OA, don't accept anyone else's plan of eating. Look to see whether it works for you. Because there are many people around here, there are many controlling sponsors, I'll be talking about that a lot more tomorrow, who say, do it my way or I won't work with you. And I don't think that, personally, I think that's contrary to the pact that we make in step 12 to carry the message to everyone who suffers compulsively. And I think it's contrary to the message of tradition 5, which says the job of every group is to carry the message to those who still suffer. I think flexibility is needed. And I think it's doubly important for us not to impose our problem, our plan of eating on someone else. I mean, I have all kinds of feelings about what I think should be on people's plans of eatings, and I don't express them. I examine them. I question them very carefully on how honest they're being with themselves. But and I think you need some analysis. But anyway, so I spent time on that. And I offered, you know, I'd be happy at any break or something to ask any questions or things of that sort. By the way, there is an Ask It basket here. It's such a large group. It's very difficult to be interrupted and then to get back on track. And if I started to be interrupted by one person, then, you know, we would. So there's an Ask It basket. I've been at, I picked up two questions, and one of them I'm going to answer right away. The other one, I'm going to hold off until step 11. So I won't answer your question immediately, but I'll put it in at the appropriate step. I talked about how the Big Book uses the word allergy to describe this craving, and I explained what I had not known until I began to study the book carefully, that when this book was written and when Dr. Silkworth had developed his theory of this craving, he called it a phenomenon because a phenomenon is an unexplained occurrence. When he developed this theory, he called it an allergy because in those days the word allergy was used to talk about in a very general way, very generic way, an adverse, a detrimental, a harmful reaction to a substance. Not what we now think of as allergies because of the pills we take, you know, to hives or diarrhea or rashes or things of that sort, or anaphylactic shock, which are just plain physical. Our allergic detrimental reaction is cravings. So it was properly used then. It couldn't be used now to any normal, you know, any person who speaks English these days, because the word allergy has taken on a much more specialized meaning. So when I speak to newcomers, I don't normally use the word allergy, because it just doesn't make sense to them. We're going to be coming to the word selfish when we talk about step 3 and step 4. And the word selfish used in the big book is not the way the word selfish is used now, or frankly even the way it was used back then. Talking about people who are here for the first time, whenever a newcomer comes into my meeting, I will usually say fresh blood, you know, because, you know, this program only has life in it if we give away what we've been given. Just to be around a whole bunch of people who all do the same thing and have all recovered is not going to keep us abstinent, and I'll talk about that tomorrow as well. So, I think I've covered all the explanatory stuff. Anyone who wants more of a recap of what I said yesterday, who wasn't here yesterday, I'll be happy to talk to that person. We are on is this okay? You can hear me? We're on Bill's story, and I'm going to be very quick on this one. Bill is Bill Wilson. It's on page 1. From now on, except for one small exception, whether you have a fourth edition or a third edition of the big book, it makes no difference. Now, Bill Wilson was a pretty brilliant hustler. Salesman most of his life, studied philosophy, studied law, had very clear leadership abilities, knew it. And he didn't drink until the Great War, United States' entry into the Great War in 1917. He talks on page 1 about he was part of life at last when he started to drink. And his story doesn't always ring a bell with people in OA, so I'm just going to give you a real, very quick overview. He gets into the stock market. He's drinking a lot. He's enjoying himself. He's going to bars and jazz clubs. And his wife is a little concerned, but he tells them that men of genius need sort of these creative flights. Talks about a fascinating thing. Lois actually chronicled this. Diary of hobo, of a hobo life or something, where he was the first person, apparently, certainly one of the people, apparently, who thought that if people were going to be selling stocks, they should know a lot about the companies that, whose stocks they were selling. And he actually sort of went undercover and worked in various factories on the East Coast of the United States to find out what these companies were doing and what developments, what inventions were coming up, and then would give advice to stockbrokers. And he made lots of money doing that. He makes lots of money. On page 3, right in the middle, for the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived. There was always this feeling of being outside of things, an outsider looking in. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. So I relate to that, because I grew up in a family in which food was love. And the dinner table was a central part of our existence. And I understand, and then when I was dating my wife, we would go out to eat a lot. I always wondered why she didn't eat as much as I did, but I had no idea how much I was eating. I was amazed. We'd go out for dinner, I'd eat. We'd go to a movie, I'd eat the huge bag of popcorn. And then we go for a late night snack at a pizza place. And she would have a piece of pizza and cut it and sort of move it around, and I'd eat the rest of the pizza. And I thought she was weird. And then it gets worse. Second last paragraph on page 3. My drinking assumed more serious proportions. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. So now he's isolating. And then the Black Tuesday, the stock market falls apart. People are throwing themselves out of windows in despair. And on page 4, he says, that disgusted me. I wouldn't jump. I went back to the bar. And then he goes to Montreal. He gets a business opportunity in Montreal. That's in Canada, for those of you who... And he screws that up because he gets drunk. And then he lives with his with his in-laws. And on page, and he has no work, none at all. On page 5, liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. And that's a moment that some of us don't reach yet. And, I'm not sure I reached that before I joined OA. I probably had, but not consciously. I mean, clearly food was necessary. I don't mean food. I mean the foods I used to crave or the foods that created cravings in me. But I'm not sure I was conscious that I absolutely needed them, that I needed my fix. It may be more obvious if there's one substance and you know what it is and you can't keep away from it. Then, you know, if pizza wasn't available, I'd have ice cream. You know, I mean, so I wasn't necessarily aware that I was addicted to whatever it was that was in common with both pizza and ice cream, which, for me has been a problem. And then he gets a wonderful business opportunity and that falls flat. And that's an interesting story worth telling. He tells about it in his history of AA called AA Comes of Age, another piece of OA approved literature and a brilliant book. He's obviously a very brilliant guy, and people are putting together a bid to take over a company, and they say to him, if you can keep sober until the moment we sign the contract to take it over, you can be the president of the company. And this was coming from a guy who had not had a job for years. This was a real opportunity. 3 days before, he's in a hotel room, and someone comes up, prohibition times, with a jug. Says, got some whiskey here. I'm going to pass it around. Someone gives it to Bill. You want some, Bill? No, not drinking, because he signed this contract. You know, I will not drink until... Comes around the second time, wants some, Bill? No, not drinking. Comes around the third time, and the guy who brought it says, you know, boys, this is Applejack whiskey from Tennessee. You can't get it in this state. Bang. Bill drinks it. And he loses everything. He loses everything. He tries again. He goes back I'm looking for the Armistice Day one. Oh, it's coming, yeah. And he just doesn't know where he is. He brings his mattress to the floor. He puts his mattress on the main floor because he's afraid of jumping out of the second story. All the things. But on page 7, he's placed into a hospital for the rehabilitation of alcoholics. This is the Towns Hospital in New York, and it is presided over. The medical officer there was Dr. Silkworth, who had developed this theory. And he says on page 7, best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I have been seriously ill bodily and mentally. And the bodily part was the news. Because everyone knew that alcoholics had some mental problems, but no one had this idea that there was also this physical problem that I just described this morning. He says, it relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. But he drinks again. And this time, he goes back to the hospital, and Dr. Silkworth on the bottom of page 7 says, he's hopeless. I can't help him. He says this to Lois. Either he's going to be committed to an asylum or he's going to die. And he says at page 7, they did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea right at the bottom. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities and my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now I was to plunge into the dark, joining that endless processions of sots, alcoholics, who had gone on before. Next paragraph. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass swamp, bitter swamp of self-pity. Interesting language he uses, because it's not this horrible situation I found myself in, this swamp of self-pity, because that is what it was. From his perspective now of sobriety and recovery, it was a bitter swamp of self-pity, and we'll go into that later. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. So after the second time of being in the asylum, he knows that not only can he not stop once he's started, but even knowing that he shouldn't be drinking alcohol, he can't stop from starting again. He can't, and we'll be spending some time discussing that. He can't stop from going back to it. Even though he may be have gone cold turkey sufficiently that his body isn't saying more, his mind is saying more. And we'll be dealing with the mind problem. So knowing that combination, that's a vicious circle. If you can't stop once you've started, and you can't stop from starting, you're in a vicious circle all the time, which explains all the yo-yo dieting I've ever done. Well, he gets sober again for a little while, and then an amazing story, which he decides he's going to go golfing on Armistice Day. He lives in Brooklyn. He has to go to Staten Island to go to the golf course. He takes a bus from Brooklyn into Manhattan, then a bus down from Manhattan from, I don't know which bridge. I don't know New York well enough to know what bridge was there at the time. But he then had to take a bus from the top of Manhattan to the Staten Island Ferry. The bus breaks down. He gets into a conversation with a man next to him. They're told that there will be another bus in an hour. They go to a bar. The man orders a beer. Bill orders a ginger ale, I think. I don't know. I don't remember. And the man says, why aren't you drinking? And Bill starts to explain Dr. Silkworth, his whole history of alcoholism, why he's not drinking, all the problems he's had to his entire life, hours and hours of tales. And well, within the hour, the bus comes. They get on the bus. Bill continues to talk. They get to Staten Island. They take the ferry. They get to Staten Island. The man says, well, I'm going to go to a gun range to practice my shooting. You're going golfing. But it's lunchtime. Why don't we grab a bite to eat before, and then we'll go our separate ways? Sure. Only place open on Armistice Day was the bar. Bill is about to order ginger ale. Bartender comes up and says, boys, it's Armistice Day. Have one on me. Sets two beers, a beer in front of each of them. Bill drinks the beer. And the man says, you just spent 3 hours telling me that you can't have one beer or you'll go back into, you must be insane. Yes, says Bill, I am. And if any of you ever saw that wonderful movie with James Woods and James Garner, I forgot what it's called, but Bill W, I think it's called, yeah. That's depicted there, where he's crawling home, at midnight with his golf clubs gone and the sadness that Lois feels. And then the violins start near the end of that bleak November. I'm drinking in my kitchen. There's enough gin to last me the night. And the telephone rings, and it's a cheerful voice of an old friend. Friend was Ebbie Thatcher. Ebbie Thatcher was a person who Bill said about, if I ever get as bad as he, I'll have to quit drinking. Ebbie was an absolute drunk, came from a wealthy family. Bill lived in, I always forget where he lived in Vermont. He lived in a small town of Vermont, which was also a summer residence for a lot of wealthy people. Dorset, East Dorset, Vermont. And Ebbie would visit every summer, and they were very close friends for a very long time. And Ebbie was a horrible drunk. He phones Bill, and as Bill points out, he was sober, top of page 9. And then he comes in, and the door opened. He stood there fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? Right in the middle of page 9, I pushed a drink across the table. He refused it. According to AA Comes of Age, he said, I'm not drinking. And now comes probably my favorite sentence in the big book, because it's the way Bill spoke as well as the way he wrote. Come, what's all this about? I queried. I'll make you bet that you know no one who talks like that. Come, what's all this about? I queried. And Bill says, and Evie says, I've got religion. I'll talk a little bit later about what Evie had, but this statement, I've got religion, he had found a Christian God, puts Bill off into a 1.5-page rant. And I'm going to talk about that when we get to We Agnostics. But after he goes into the rant about God and all the horrors and the wars that have been started over that, Bill also says on page 11, that right in the middle, he says, the last sentence of the paragraph that ends in the middle, if there was a devil, he seemed the boss universal. He certainly had me. But my friend sat before me and he made the point blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. That was, you know, step one. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he'd ever known. Had this power originated in him? Obviously it had not. There'd been no more power in him than there was in me in that minute, and this was none at all. This is the identification that we need to give in step one. I've been there. I know where you are. I had no power, just as you have no power, if you're like me. And then he says, that floored me. It began to look as though religious people were right after all. Here was something at work in the human heart which had done the impossible. That's one of the reasons I love the big book. It's just the line. Occasionally, Bill comes up with these wonderful lines. Here was something at work in the human heart which had done the impossible. I think that's just a great line. Never mind about the musty past. Here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table. He shouted great tidings. So Bill saw this miracle. He saw that not only had Ebby, he knew that Ebby was a horrible drunk, and he knew Ebby well, but he also saw a person who was completely different. But he says, I still can't believe in the God that you believe in. And Ebby said something then that changed the course of my life, actually. And he did what his particular religious group might not have wanted him to do. But he said, right in the middle of page 12, why don't you choose your own conception of God? And Bill says, that floored me. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadows I had lived and shivered many years. He goes on, it was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Above a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Now, in another book, which is OA Approved Literature, the book is... actually, this is from AA Comes of Age. I thought it was another book. Bill summarized what Ebby said to him. And listen to this and how simple it was compared to how complex you may find it in OA. Well, what did you do? And this is what Bill said. Well, this is in AA Come... No, I'm sorry. This is in The Language of the Heart. It is a book of essays, all the essays that Bill wrote for our equivalent of Lifeline magazine, Grapevine, the AA equivalent, Grapevine. Well, says Ebby, you know, you get honest with yourself. You make a self-survey, step four. You talk it out with the other guy, step five. You quit living alone and begin to get straight with the world around by making restitution, step nine. You try the giving that demands no reward, either in approval, prestige, or money, step 12. And you ask whatever higher power there is, even if it's just an experiment, to help you find the grace to be released from alcoholism. That will turn into step 11. How simple. Step 4, step 5, step 9, step 11, step 12. Five steps. And we've made it a lot more complicated than that. In the early days, some people, charismatic people like Dr. Bob, the co-founder of AA, could take people through steps 4 through 9 in a day. And we take months, years. And the big book method will take you weeks, It won't take you months. So, and then Bill is in the town's hospital again. I mean, he buys four bottles of beer in Brooklyn. He walks into the town's hospital with what the last of the beers in his hand. He says, Dr. Silkworth, this time I think I found something. And Silkworth says, sure you have, my boy. Come on in. So he drives him out. And then Ebby visits him again on page 15 and 13, and you'll see that Bill goes through steps 3, step 4, step 5, step 6, step 7, step 8, and because he's about to reform himself in relation to his wife, he's halfway through step 9, which is making a living amends to his wife. At least that's my approach. And he has this incredible spiritual experience, page 14. The second full paragraph there, right in the middle, there was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. Then comes a very significant sentence. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. Then he's alarmed. He calls for the doctor. Silkworth comes in. Am I crazy? Because there's a skeptic in him. And Dr. Silkworth, you know, there's a wonderful talk by Clancy I, a great AA speaker, where he talks about the thin threads that could have been broken, but that hold AA together. And this is, you know, one of them was Ebby saying, why don't you try your own conception of God? The other one was this one. Because all Dr. Silkworth had to do was say, you've been sober for only 3 days. You're still experiencing the delirium tremens. Yes, you're crazy, but it'll go away. But instead, Silkworth said, something has happened to you I don't understand, but you better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were. I mean, what a gift. You know, it's very humbling for a scientist, a doctor, you know, to say, I don't know what's going on with you, but grab it, you know? So, you know, that's Bill's story, and then we're on to there is a solution. I was asked one question, why is it good to say you have an allergy? If people offer you food and you have to say no, you can say, I just discovered I had an allergy, and most people will just not, you know, thank you for making it for me, but I've just discovered I'm allergic to this food, so I can't eat it, but I really appreciate the effort you went to. Very few people will go beyond that and ask you, well, what is your allergic reaction? But if you do, I gave three possible scenarios. And the one I gave, and I was asked to give this script, I can't repeat it word for word because it isn't a word for word kind of script. I'm glad you asked. I'm in Overeaters Anonymous. You know, if you know anyone who might benefit from knowing more, who appears to have an addictive food problem, food addiction, please let me know. It will do me good to help them or to carry my message to them. I have found that I cannot eat certain foods without developing the same kind of craving that an alcohol gets when he or she drinks one drink of alcohol. I hope that answers that question. Okay, page 17, we're on to the chapter, There is a Solution. The big book is going to spend two more chapters repeating the lessons that can be learned from Dr. Silkworth's doctor's opinion and from Bill's story. On page 17, is the, I don't know which liner had recently, crashed. I don't know, when did the Titanic go? 1920 something. Something like that. Probably think of the Titanic, but there are many others. They talk about how what keeps us together as a fellowship, and is it? It's not that we've been rescued from a common problem, because people are rescued from common problems. They're all glad and they're all happy, and then they go their separate ways. What keeps us together? And we're both from steerage and the high and the luxury suites, where we come together. People who would not normally meet, and boy, is that true. But the last paragraph on that page is the tremendous fact for every one of us is that we've discovered a common solution. And that solution is the 12 steps. And the 12th step is we must band together to help others. We have to help others. If we band together, we can help many more others than if we did it individually. We have found a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. You may not know this, but until this book was published, the fellowship was not called Alcoholics Anonymous. The book named the fellowship. The fellowship didn't name the book. If Bill had had his way, it would have been Bill's book, he says. I think he's a little exaggerating. And a whole bunch of people wanted to be called The Way Out. And one of, a person who lived in Washington went to the Library of Congress and found that there were a whole bunch of books already named The Way Out, so that they agreed on Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to go quickly through this, but only point out the significant parts. Page 20. Right at the top says, you may already have asked yourself why it is that all of us became so very ill from drinking. Doubtless you're curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered, not we are recovering, but we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. Again, that theme of mind and body. It's not just the mental issue. If you're an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? It's the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. We shall tell you what we have done. What do I have to do? Do what we did. You'll have what we have. But then they begin to summarize some points. Right at the bottom, they distinguish between the moderate and heavy drinker and the real alcoholic. The moderate drinker, they say, has little trouble in giving up liquor entirely. Then we have the certain type of hard drinker, may have the habit badly enough to impair him. But both of these can stop. And then they say, what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts. So that's the body issue. That's the cravings. That's the first definition of the real alcoholic, is that that person must have what the big book describes as an allergy of the body, this abnormal reaction of cravings to the substance. If you don't have that, then you're a heavy drinker, or you're a drinker who has some mental problems, but it's not something that the steps necessarily will help you deal with. From the big book perspective, the real alcoholic is a person who cannot stop once he or she has started. And on page 22, some very important words, right in the middle. Why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle, another catastrophe, with all its attendant, its ongoing, the accompanying suffering and humiliation, why is it he takes that one drink? Now the big book is going from the first question, which is, do you have these abnormal reactions once you start these cravings, to the first, the real question, the obvious real question. Why do you even have some? Why do you have that first drink? Why do you let yourself go into this horrible, swamp that you know you're going to get into? Because you know perfectly well you can't handle your liquor. You can't drink. Can't drink anything. Because once you start, you can't stop. And the big book says, perhaps there never will be a full answer to these questions. Opinions, this is the second last paragraph of the page, page 22. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We are not sure why, once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. We're not psychologists, and we're not therapists, we're not doctors. We ought never to be giving any advice on that in that area, even though we may have a lot of knowledge. Even though we may be doctors or therapists, as compulsive eaters, we don't know the answer for the individual, for the other person. And we don't know it for ourselves, and it's not important why. My mother told me how guilty she felt because when she was nursing me, she was told for every 4 hours on the dot, don't worry if he cries in the middle. So it wasn't feeding on demand. Who knows? Maybe when I was a baby, I didn't get the milk when I wanted it, and that changed my mind and my body. I don't know. Maybe she weaned me too early, or maybe it was just all the wonderful food, or maybe I have a gene in me that causes this cravings, and it was triggered by the kind of food that I was fed. Maybe some people have that same gene, aren't triggered because they eat British food. And, so we cannot answer the riddle. So the big book goes on. It says, we know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens both in the bodily and mental sense. Body, more. Mind, I give up. I can't control you. Which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. And then on page 23, these observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. And as I said yesterday, I don't apologize or feel guilty for the fact that I need glasses to read with and to see more clearly at a distance, that I'm wearing a hearing aid now because in one ear because my hearing has deteriorated in that ear. I don't apologize that at the age of 72, I can't walk up the steps as quickly as I used to be able to. I mean, I accept my body in so many other ways. Why can't I accept and know that I can't eat butter? That's me personally, can't eat butter, and just not eat butter. Oh, I just guess I just can't eat butter. You know, you will die if you eat peanuts. You will die if you eat shrimps. Oh, I guess I won't eat shrimp. I guess I won't eat peanuts. You know, my wife needs that one square of chocolate, dark chocolate, specific kind, every day. I think it's the caffeine personally, but because she doesn't take anything else with caffeine, because she gets headaches if she doesn't, but she needs that one square. But if someone said to her, this is now poison for you, we've done tests on you, and if you have another piece of chocolate, you know, you'll die. My wife is sane enough to say, well, I guess I just won't have any chocolate. I mourn it, I'll miss it, I'll suffer headaches, but I guess I won't eat chocolate, because she's a sane human being. But never before I worked the 12 steps of Overeater Anonymous while being abstinent did I ever have this thought, maybe I shouldn't eat this. You know, all my history has shown me that once I start eating this, I'll stop. I can't stop. Maybe I just won't start. I always had all these excuses, these rationales for having a little bit, just a little bit. I was aided and abetted by every diet I'd ever read, which told me I could have a little bit and it would be fine once I lost my weight. I was aided and abetted by this wish to, you know, to please people, you know, it was really more to myself, for myself, by tasting it and having a little bit. So the chances, you know, so they go on, the main problem centered in his mind rather than his body. If you ask him why he started on that last bender, the chances are he will offer you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc, the chaos an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of the man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious, this false reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he'll laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. Once in a while, he may tell the truth. And the truth, strange to say, is usually that he has no more idea why he took that first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses with which they are satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts, they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady, this illness, has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. There is the obsession. This is the second concept, the mind problem, the mental obsession, that somehow, someday, they will beat the game. An obsession is an idea that takes control of your mind to the exclusion of all others. And that's the obsession. What is the obsession? That we will beat the game this time. It will be different this time. And the big book's going to, a whole chapter is going to be spent on this obsession, so I'm just going to go on. Page 24, right at the top, at a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. This tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it's suspected. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We're unable, at certain times, to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. All the reasons why go out of our mind, and they're overtaken by this thing as, yeah, have some. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us, to stop us. If these thoughts occur, they're hazy. So this is ambiguous. Oh, maybe I shouldn't. And readily supplanted, replaced with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There's a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. Now, unless you've lived in cold climate, as I have, you might not quite understand this analogy. I've never touched a hot stove, but I have, and only once, put my tongue on the window of a car in 40 below weather. Never did that again. Never. Because I learned my lesson. And I just never learned my lesson when it came to food. Page 25. There is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, step 4. The leveling of our pride, step 5. And the confession of shortcomings, step 5. Which the process requires... I'm sorry, I should translate. Which the process requires... for its successful consummation. Canadians have more of a British pronunciation. But we saw that it really worked in others. We had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, not was being solved, not was, well, maybe kind of, it had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. And I heard the speaker once say, you know, to pick up something that's laid at your feet, you got to kneel. And it's kind of a neat concept. I don't think that's literally true, especially if you're able to touch your toes, but the idea of kneeling, of humbly picking something up is pretty good. We have found much of heaven. We've been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which you'd not even dream. The great fact is just this and nothing less. Nothing less than this. That we've had deep and effective spiritual experiences, note the asterisk, which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. I believe it's lives and not lives. It's not into our hearts and lives, it's hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. Note the asterisk. It says, fully explained, Appendix 2. Page 27, it says, for amplification, see Appendix 2. And on page 47, it says, please read Appendix 2. So Appendix 2 on spiritual experience is found on the fourth edition. On page 567, and in the third edition on page 569. Here's a joke that's going to fall flat. This appendix was put in the second printing of the first edition in 1941. And I guess I'll have to make it pretty obvious as a joke. And this appendix has never been taken out. Usually I say this appendix was put in 1941. It's never been taken out and just goes way over everyone's head. So there's a joke for you. You can have it. And this appendix was put in because they began to realize that people kept expecting to have these awakenings, these experiences, like Bill's. Remember, Bill said, God comes to most people gradually, but to me he came quickly. And Bill was talking about all these, you know, this sudden experience and a whole bunch of the stories in the back of the big book of the first edition, plus one or two in the book itself. The first 160, the equivalent of the first 164 pages, were all these sudden ones. Who are you to say there is no God, comes the voice, you know, and suddenly I'm swept up in this joy and all these things. And people kept saying, I don't want to drink anymore, but nothing like that has ever happened to me. So they wrote this appendix, and they actually changed step 12 to take out the word experience and put in awakenings as it is now. So having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Now, it used to say having had a spiritual experience as these results. So they want to make a distinction between awakening, which is a slower, more gradual thing, and experience, which is the sudden, you know, you're healed kind of thing. And in the first paragraph of this appendix, they equate the words spiritual experience and the words spiritual awakening, the phrase, with, and thank goodness they put this in, these words, the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. Do you see it? It says the term spiritual experience, fast, spiritual awakening, slow, are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself, shown itself among us in many different ways. So what is it? What do they equate spiritual experience and spiritual awakening with? A personality change sufficient to overcome alcoholism. Not God awareness, God consciousness. This is the generic word, phrase that's used to describe a spiritual awakening. And I'm very thankful for it, being a person who has no belief in a supernatural being. All I need to have in order to recover is a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism, or from in my case, from compulsive eating. And the test of that is real simple. Can I look at other people eat this stuff and not want it? Am I tempted to go back? I'm not. I've had that personality change sufficient to combat, to bring about my recovery from compulsive eating. I don't have to walk around and I don't have to believe in anything if I've had that personality change. And then they go on and say, our first printing gave people the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. This is wrong. It wasn't our intention, they go on in the third paragraph, to do this. Many alcoholics have concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. No. Those transformations aren't the rule. In the next paragraph, most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes he's undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life. You know, that's another wonderful phrase. It's his reaction to life that is another part of the test of this personality change. That such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months, not years, a few months, could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. Just turn the page, please. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he doesn't close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness, H-O-W-H-O, are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. Then comes a quote, which is evidently not from Herbert Spencer. It's from a minister named Pater. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. Okay, back to back to page 25. Actually, page 26. Story of Roland Hazard, a certain American businessman. 1931. Wealthy, family. Gone to a psychiatrist in the United States, evidently had quite a bit of therapy from that psychiatrist, and then went to see, originally, supposedly, Sigmund Freud, who was too busy, went to see Sigmund Freud's disciple, Alfred Adler, too busy. They were both, I think, in Berlin, or, no, Vienna. And then he went to see Carl Jung in Switzerland. Jung had split with Adler and Freud over the issues between spirituality and sexuality. As I understand it, I'm no scholar of the history of psychology and psychiatry. And he went through sufficient, there's some doubt as to how long it was, but sufficient therapy with Jung that he felt that he had finally conquered everything. He knew what his problems were, and he would no longer drink. And yet he drank as soon as he left Dr. Jung. And came back to Dr. Jung, a complete wreck, and saying, is there no hope? And Dr. Jung says, no, there is no hope for you. I cannot do anything for you. And then he says, and page 27, the doctor says, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. Now, Joe and Charlie point out, Dr. Jung was no physician. He didn't know Dr. Silkworth's theory about the body problem. He only knew the mind problem. So he says, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I've never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent it does in you. Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. He said to the doctor, is there no exception? Oh, yes, said the doctor, there is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. Phenomena is the plural of phenomenon, and it means I can't explain them. They occur, but I can't explain them. I don't know why they occur. This is in history. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements, so the emotions are moved around. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly, and again, Dr. Jung had suddenly, but the big book will give you an asterisk there and say, it's not sudden necessarily for us. It can be very slow. It can be an awakening. Are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. In fact, I'd been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangement within you. With many individuals, the methods which I employed are successful, but I've never been as successful with an alcoholic of your description. Everyone said, but I'm the deacon of a church. I have great belief in God. And Jung said, that's not what we're talking about. I'm talking about a rearrangement of the whole psyche. Roland went back to New York. I don't know if he's in New York. He went back to the States, and he discovered the Oxford groups. The Oxford groups had developed themselves around a man named Frank Buckman, who had been a Presbyterian minister in Pennsylvania, and it had a big rift with his congregation, and had just left in disgust, angry at them, angry at the world. And he went to Oxford, England, not to study at Oxford University, but just to be in a quiet, contemplative place. After a while, he began to realize that the rift he had with his congregation was his responsibility. His trying to force them to do things that they didn't want to do. And he wrote them. And he also began to realize that his real problem was he had completely lost his passion for Christ. That even though he was a minister, he no longer had the passion he had when he first started off as a minister. He had lost that. And that was really what was going on with him. So he wrote a letter of apology to his congregation. And I don't know whether it was sudden or a shorter period or a longer period of time, but he began to reawaken his passion for Christ. And he started to look at that and say, well, what happened? What did I do that caused this reawakening in me, this spiritual transformation? And he did a lot of studying, and he came to the conclusion that it was that he had done a self-analysis and had made atonement for his mistakes, had confessed his mistakes and made atonement for them. And he developed this very simple concept. You get honest with yourself, you get honest with another person, you make restitution for the harms that you've done, and you help people without hope of reward, property, or prestige, and you pray a lot for guidance. And around him developed this group of people who called themselves the Oxford groups, and they began to preach that kind of concept within the Protestant church. So they were trying to create a movement that was outside of the church or another sect or denomination. But they were trying to encourage people to work within the Protestant church's denominations to infuse the passion for Christ, to get that going, to get that concept. It became very, very powerful force within the Protestant church. Catholics would have nothing to do with them, of course. As a matter of fact, the Catholic church had its Oxford movement and asked the Oxford groups to change the name because they didn't want them to be confused. They did, to moral rearmament, that's what it's known as today. And And they were very significant in those days. So that's what Roland found, and he did what they told him to do, and he had a passion for Christ that was reawakened, and he no longer wanted to drink. And one day, two fellow Oxford groupers named Shep and Sebra, wonderful names, huh? Came to him and said, "We found this drunk in East Dorset, Vermont. His name is Eddie. He's about to be sentenced by one. It was the father of one of them. I can't remember whether Shep or Sebra. He's about to be sentenced to an asylum, but we know what you did with your alcoholism, and maybe you could go to the judge and say, I'll take him under my wing and we'll see what we can do for him." And Roland did that, and Abby got honest with another human being, did a self-analysis, got honest with another human being, made restitution of the harms that he had done, began to pray within the Oxford groups, and thought of carrying the message to Bill. And that's what he did. And so you have Carl Jung, who knew the solution. The solution to alcoholism was a spiritual awakening, spiritual experience, a transformation. He didn't know how to do it for the alcoholic. He could do it with others, but he couldn't do it for the alcoholic. He knew there was, but he didn't know how to get it. Here was the Oxford groups who had a method for getting a spiritual awakening, a spiritual experience. Ebby brings the method and the message of Dr. Jung that this was the solution to Bill, who knew the problem. Because Dr. Silkworth had told him what the problem was. The problem is in your mind. Your body is abnormal and you just won't accept that your body is abnormal, that your mind will not remember that you can't eat that or that you can't drink that. And Bill was the first person to put them all together because he had the explanation of the problem from Dr. Silkworth, the explanation of the solution from Dr. Jung, and the solution and the steps to take to get the solution from the Oxford groups. Many years later, and just before Dr. Jung died, Bill wrote a letter to Dr. Jung. And he thanked him for all that, for his role in the creation of AA. And Dr. Jung wrote him back, and I we'll run out of time, but what the hell. He wrote back a letter that can be found, again, in the language of the heart, and you can find it on the internet. Just write Dr. Jung, Bill Wilson letter, and you'll get a copy of that. And he says, "Your letter was very welcome indeed. I had no news from Roland H. anymore. I often wondered what had been his fate." You know, and one of the reasons for that is that until 1955, with the second edition of the big book, Dr. Jung's name was not mentioned in the big book. So it was only 5 years, this is 1961, only 4 or 5 years since Dr. Jung was even mentioned as a person who played a role in AA. Jimmy, he then says, "Our conversation, which he has adequately reported to you," so Dr. Jung is saying this was a true conversation, "had an aspect of which he didn't know," and he goes on to say, "I couldn't tell him that, I was beset upon on all sides, I had to be careful what I said, I was misunderstood." Then he says this, "His craving for alcohol was the equivalent, and I would say his mental, he would use craving here for what we would use his obsession, his mind, was the equivalent on a low level of the spiritual thirst of our being," and we could easily substitute the word hunger of our being, "for wholeness, expressed in medieval language, the union with God." And he says, "How can you formulate such an insight in a language that isn't misunderstood?" Then he goes on and explains how you get such an experience. How do you get this wholeness, this feeling of wholeness with God? Says it can only happen to you in reality, and it can only happen to you when you walk in a path which leads you to higher understanding. He says, "You might be led to this goal by an act of grace or through a personal and honest contact with friends." In other words, by occurrences within your life that lead you that way. The sudden realization, God's looking out for me, or God is speaking to me through others, maybe through my minister or something of that sort. Or through a personal honest contact with friends, I said that. Or, so that's one way, your own experience leads you to that, and that happens to a lot of people in this world. or through a higher education of the mind beyond the confines, the boundaries of mere rationalism. In other words, go get out of logic and explore the inner workings of spirituality. I see from your letter that Roland H. has chosen the second way, which was, under the circumstances, obviously the best one. I'm strongly convinced that the evil principle prevailing in this world leads this unrecognized spiritual need, this need for wholeness, into perdition, into hell. If it isn't counteracted either by real religious spiritual insight or by the protective wall of human community. And what does the 12-step fellowship give for every addict? Both spiritual insight and the protective wall of human community. So we've got the double aspect, which Dr. Jung said at least one of is needed. It's a wonderful letter. I'm not going to do the whole thing, but he says, he points out that alcohol in Latin is spiritus, and we use the same word spiritus for the highest religious experience. So he says the helpful formula in Latin is spiritus, spirituality, contra, against, spiritum, alcohol. Spiritus contra spiritum. All my years of taking left.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I thought I'd turn that off. I will not answer that.
Busted.
Yeah, that's terrible.
It's your
call. Now the chapter Morbid Alcoholism. This whole chapter is devoted to the mind, this mental obsession. I'm going to go through it relatively quickly, because I've talked about it at some length already. But the first couple, we used to, in the old days, when I was in 1986, when I joined the program, we used to read, this is one of the things we used to read at the beginning of a meeting. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. Again, the big book has defined real alcoholism, and they go back. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from other people. So the real alcoholic is both a body and a mind problem. Therefore, it's not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts, futile attempts, to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking. So control is have it in minute quantities and still enjoy it, still get the satisfaction. Is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. And Joe and Charlie go through this and point out how all the words in here are death, insanity, really quite morbid thoughts. But we've lost, they go on, we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. We have to accept that the problem describes us, that this problem of the mind and the body together, this double whammy, you can't stop once you've started and you can't stop from starting, that's what describes us. Once we accept that, it becomes obvious what we have to do. We have to stop indulging the things that cause us cravings, and then we have to work the steps which will change our minds and not persuade us to go back to the things we've given up. It's that simple. We confuse it a lot in OA, and I think according to Joe and Charlie, it's confused a lot in AA. But it's a simple formula. Our real problem is in our body, is in our mind, because we simply do not accept the reality of the body. We're in the river of denial. Any of you saw Monty Python and the Holy Grail will remember the black knight who doesn't acknowledge that his hands are cut off and his legs are cut off. And that's certainly how I certainly feel in retrospect. That's exactly where I was, you know. They go on, the delusion that we are like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. We alcoholics or men and women have lost the ability to control our drinking. No real alcoholic ever recovers control. Next paragraph, we are like men who have lost their legs, they never grow new ones. And, I mean, this simple acknowledgement that based on your experience, you cannot eat, based on my experience, I cannot eat, say, butter. I cannot eat ice cream. Because once I do, I will end up eating the tub of ice cream. I will end up putting the butter in slabs on bread or something like that, or eating it in other forms and desserts and things. I mean, it's obvious. My history shows that. But the obsession that it's not true, that maybe this time it will be different, is what the big book is going to discuss. They provide a couple of tests. Bottom of page 31. You can diagnose yourself, step over to the nearest barroom and try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and stop abruptly. Try it more than once. Yes, I will have, as I was given in my popular weight loss program, I will have that scoop of ice cream cut off so that it's absolutely flat. It's just one little scoop. And I will eat that once a week, no more, and I will have it once a week, and let's see whether or not I will have more of it. Well, I tried that experiment because that's what I actually did. And within 6 weeks, I may be exact, maybe 2 months or 5 months, I don't remember, I was eating the tub, the whole tub of ice cream and the cookies and everything else. But that's one test. And that's the test of the body. Does the body have that craving that exists? Now, for you, it may not be ice cream. For you, it may not be butter. For you, it may be something else. Like, don't just take, I'm using my own experience, but for you, it may be some other completely different kind of food, or it may be an eating behavior that just causes you just to wolf down. It may be any time I see my mother, I go home and I take it all in. Well, that's obviously your excuse for doing it. They give then an example of a man of 30 who had quit for 25 years, retired at the age of 55, made a lot of money. Thought that his sobriety for 25 years gave him license to have a little bit. And he's dead within 3 years because he goes right back into the alcohol, and dead within 4 years. And this is the example of with a statement that I've heard so often that makes so much sense to me, that my illness is doing push-ups outside the rooms of OA. It's getting stronger and stronger. I believe that. I really, you know, there are some cancers, and prostate cancer is evidently one of them, that even if you rid the body of them, they will come back within a number of years, some of them, as if they had been growing slowly all this time. And I believe that that's the case. I believe that my cravings would be even stronger if I went back to them than they were 25 years when I stopped indulging in them. So page 33, this case contains a powerful lesson. Most of us have believed that if we remained sober for a long stretch, we could thereafter drink normally. But here is a man who at 55 years found he was just where he had left off at 30. We've seen the truth demonstrated again and again, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. If we are planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind nor any lurking, hidden notion that someday we'll be immune to alcohol. The big book then does its absolute best to send a message to women and to young people who aren't as bad as they are. It tries. Boy, it tries. It doesn't do a great job of it, but you can see that in these next two paragraphs, they got young men and women, and they say, you don't have to be down in the gutter to recognize that you may be a real alcoholic. You know, this just isn't necessarily for gutter drunks, for gutter male drunks. They do their best. It just wasn't terrific. And then on page 34, they give you the second test of whether you're a real alcoholic. Stop for a year. See if you can. And that's the mind. So they've given you the body test. Control yourself. See if you get the cravings. Now they're giving you the mind test. See if you can stop for a year. And then they go on the middle of the page, on page 24. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We're assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. And then they say at the bottom, how then shall we help our readers determine whether they're one of us? Experiment of quitting will be helpful, but let us describe on page 35 some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking. Let's describe what goes on in our minds just before that first drink. For obviously, this is the crux of the problem, the heart of the problem. What sort of thinking, again, here's some wonderful language, dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Isn't that a wonderful wonderfully descriptive. I'm going to try it this time. You know, it's sort of like I can't. All the emotions that come behind the desperate experiment of the first drink. So they give you three examples. The first is Jim. Jim has not a happy day. His drunkenness caused him to lose the family automobile agency business. And he patches himself up a bit. AA comes. He makes a beginning in his spiritual journey, but not much of one. He ends up working for the company that he used to own as a car salesman. He's not a happy guy. He goes to work one day. Joe and Charlie make a big thing that he comes on Tuesday. Where was he on Monday? I don't know where he was on Monday. But he was irritated. He had a few words with the boss. He decides to drive into the country, see one of his prospects with the car. He stops by at a diner where he'd been stopping by for years. He orders a glass of milk and a sandwich. Nothing. That's great. Maybe I'll have another sandwich, another glass of milk. And then in the italics on page 36, suddenly the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. I ordered a whiskey, poured into the milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured as I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. You know, there's a wonderful Kathy cartoon where she's in a restaurant with her friend and she says, I'll have the pie. Friend said, Kathy, you're on a diet. I didn't eat the bun. I'll have a milkshake. Kathy, you're on a diet. I didn't eat the bun. Don't you know how important it is that I didn't eat the bun? You know? I mean, that was me. There's no question. And one more journey to the asylum. And right at the bottom in italics, he had much knowledge, or squiggly writing, as Joe and Charlie like to say. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reasons for not drinking were, on page 37, easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? Doing things, the same things over and over again, expecting different results. Albert Einstein did not say that. Apparently, its first appearance was either in the first Narcotics Anonymous 12 and 12, or in Alice Walker's writings. But whatever it is, it's a great definition. And they say this, you may think this is an extreme case. To us, it is not far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences. And here's a sentence that needs a little bit of parsing. And I will quit after we end this chapter, maybe push a little bit into 10:30. But there was always the curious mental phenomenon. A phenomenon is an occurrence for which we have no explanation. There was always this curious, this weird, that's what they mean by curious, mental occurrence that, parallel with our sound reason, so imagining parallel lines, parallel with our sound reason, there's sanity, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. So imagine two parallel lines, one of them is insanity and one of them is sanity. And I always liken it, because I grew up with Disney cartoons, well, with cartoons in the 50s, to the angel and the devil on the shoulders of the cartoon characters, the goofy angel and devil, or the Pluto angel and devil, or actually Tom and Jerry, they had angels and devils too. And on the one side, I won't do the Mickey voice, is the sane angel saying, don't do it. This is bad for you. If you do it, you're going to go back to what you used to be. You've been a drunk. Don't drink again. Don't have this. You know what's going to happen. You know you have this problem with your body. You know that once you start, you won't be able to stop. This is the first, don't take the first drink. This is, you know, I mean, all these sane reasons not to have it. On the other side, in my experience, is someone who says, the devil says, come on. I don't think it says anything more than that. Come on. It gives all kinds of rationales. It picks the rationale that works for you at that moment, at that time. It could be, oh, so many bad things are going on in your life. It could be so many good things are going on in your life. It could be you didn't eat the bun. It doesn't matter what the reason is. It's something that makes sense to you at that moment. And if you really have experienced that, you will have to admit that the reason given was always not right in retrospect. It never worked. However good the reason may have seemed at the time, it was wrong. Lippert points that out. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. Next day we would ask ourselves in all earnestness and sincerity how it could have happened. It's a click. Your mind just goes blank. And suddenly this stupid idea just clicks in. Oh, okay. Okay. Oh, Bill, this is Applejack whiskey from Tennessee. You can't get it here. Okay. You know, this chef is well known for, you know, making this incredible dessert. Oh, well, you know, and you're only here for a day. You got to have, okay. Yeah. They go on, in some circumstances, we've gone out deliberately to get drunk, feeling ourselves justified by nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, or the like. But even in this type of beginning, we're obliged to admit that our justification for spree was insanely insufficient in the light of what always happened. We now see that when we began to drink deliberately instead of casual, there was little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrific, meaning horrible, consequences might be. The jaywalker analogy, person loves to jaywalk, gets a thrill out of doing it, ends up breaking an arm, being hit by cars, goes to hospital, comes out, gets a hip broken, family leaves him, everything, chaos. He continues to do it. And they go on, page 38, you may think our illustration is too ridiculous, but is it? Right in the middle, we who have been through the ringer have to admit if we substituted alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly. However intelligent we may have been in other respects, where alcohol has been involved, we've been strangely insane. It's strong language, but isn't it true? And then they say, some of you may be thinking, well, now that I know I can't drink any alcohol, that's good enough. Self-knowledge is good enough. I'm not as bad as you guys are. And you know, there's a famous AA story about the two AAers who go on a 12-step call, which I'm sure no one in OA has ever been on, I'm sure that no intergroup here has ever done 12-step calls. The only one I know of was in New Zealand. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe your intergroup has this. Mine doesn't. Someone phones in and you say, we'll send two people out to talk to you. But in AA, that happens a lot more regularly. So they're doing this 12-step call and they go to this horrible apartment building that's a slum. And they go up to the fourth floor, walk up and they knock on the door. The door swings open. The stench is awful. The room is bare. There's nothing there but what looked like a pile of rags. It's not a pile of rags. It's a person. They don't know who, they can't even see what kind of a person it is, what gender, anything. And a voice says, who are you? And they say, well, we're here from Alcoholics Anonymous. We're here to help. Hey, I'm not that bad. And I remember talking to a guy. His sister asked me to phone him. She was in OA, but she couldn't get to him. And I phoned him. I said, I'll come down and talk to you. He said, no, let's just talk on the phone. So we talked. And I did everything the big book says I should do for trying to tell him allergy of the body, obsession of the mind, all that stuff. Kept saying yes, yes, yes. And I said, how much do you weigh? He said, 425 pounds, something like that. And then, or 400 pounds. And then 10 minutes later, I said, well, if you're as fat as you are and as I was, he says, what makes you think I'm fat? I said, you know, unless you're 10 feet tall and, you know, you're fat. Oh, no, he says, I'm not fat. I'm plump. I'm chubby. Huh? I don't know about you, but the mirrors I liked were right up to my neck. And I would stick my head out so that there would be no jowls and double chin. I didn't look at myself below my neck. Anyway, next example, and I know we're running into the break, but I will make this relatively quick. Fred has a great day. He's an accountant. He goes to Washington to settle something up with his client, and it all works out beautifully. But he believes he's not that bad. All he knows is he just can't drink. Doesn't do the steps, nothing. Page 41. Crosses the threshold of the dining room. The thought came to mind it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. And he gets into a horrible drunk, and now he realizes he needs help, and he starts to work the steps. And here's, so we have example of the guy who stopped for 25 years, didn't work. The guy who had a bad day, drank. The guy, the jaywalker, who is clearly simply insane. And Fred, who had a great day, and drank. And these examples are a whole spectrum of examples that you don't have to think it's just emotional. In OA, we say it's physical, emotional, and spiritual. But emotions cover only, well, cover for us, many of us, a lot of the reasons why we eat, why we can persuade ourselves to go back. But I'll tell you, if you've ever experienced the, well, they made it for me, or I didn't eat the bun, or I've exercised for 5 minutes, that's not emotional. That's just stupid. No, you know, and you know, it's just a stupid rationale. And you know, you may be emotionally as sane as you could be and still persuade yourself that you can eat this because it's made with whole grain, you know, with free-range butter. I don't know, whatever that means. You know what I mean? You know, or that the Dalai Lama blessed the yogurt that this is made from Greek yak, from yaks and Tibetan yaks or something. I mean, there isn't a rationale that I've ever come up with that was good enough, but I've come up with a whole bunch of them that were absolutely stupid enough. And so if you accept this concept that there's, that your mind will find a way to persuade you to go back, then you should be realizing at this point, and we'll stop at this point, that you are doomed if you're like me. If you have both this body problem where once you stop, you can't stop. Once you start, you can't stop. And if you acknowledge that your mind is going to be giving you permission to go back, then you are doomed. Whether you're 5 pounds overweight, 5 pounds underweight, or 60 pounds underweight, or 200 or 300 pounds overweight, you're doomed. And so, and I should have said, by the way, I didn't say that, one of the eating behaviors is not eating. It's vomiting, it's, you know, binge, it's purging, exercise purging, and all that. I mean, they're eating behaviors that develop the same kind of cravings in us. So, if you're doomed, what do? You have to find a power that's greater than yourself. We'll take a break, we'll come back.